The preceding interview, with some modification and some reduction by Oscar Brand, was broadcast nationally on March 9, 1975, as follows.
Once again, this is Oscar Brand, bringing you Voices in the Wind. And among them, Bollingen Prize poet A.R. Ammons, bringing you a glimpse of the clarion confusion of poetic expression.
The poet may or may not be a person who has a mastery of the knowledge of the tradition. He's simply a person who knows how to perform the activity. Do you realize that we've been worrying now for 2,500 years about the nature of a poem, what it is, and nobody knows yet?
Until 10 years ago, A. R. Ammons was an executive involved with the manufacture of glass equipment at a thriving New Jersey company. Many of our finest poets were successful businessmen, doctors, and lawyers. One might say American poets are in need of independent incomes. But A.R. Ammons, who's just won the prestigious Bollingen Award for Poetry for his recent collection, Sphere, The Form of Emotion, published by Norton, turned away from manufacturing in order to have more time for his daydreams. Yes, that's what he calls his poetry. He says, the poem sort of sticks up a tiny bit of itself into your attention. Then you begin with that, and you dream the poem out. Here's an example. I said, Mr. Schaefer, did you get up to see the comet? And he said, ah, no, let it go by, I don't care. He has leaves to rake, and a plunger on his washing machine isn't working right. He's not amused by 10 million mile tails, or any million mile an hour universal swoosh, or frozen gases lit by disturbances across our solar arcs. Mr. Ammons took up an academic life as resident poet at Cornell, and just recently took up residence at his alma mater, Wake Forest, at Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And there our reporter Steve Marlowe found him, still trying to explain that poetic impulse that has defied explanation for 2,500 years.
Now, as for inspiration, that is not a spooky thing, you know, inspiration. I think it's merely a matter of the attention. Suddenly your attention is seized by something, either that you've seen outside or some idea or image that occurs in the mind. And it's interesting, for whatever reason you may not be able to tell at that moment. But your attention is seized and concentrated by that, and you simply, through your interest in it, begin to work with it, and it quite often shows you something new. Each of us has his own, well, what Emerson calls genius, meaning his own nature, his own being, and each of us consequently has different needs. That genius has different needs, so we take day to day the things that interest us most from life.
You've been everything from a graduate of Wake Forest to an executive with a New Jersey glass manufacturer and other various and sundry things, a teacher. How do these various experiences work their way into your poetry? Do you ever find yourself writing about things that you've done?
Not as self-consciously. Some reviewers have created for themselves the image of me as a person out walking along the shore or in paths in the woods looking for things in nature to write about. I never look for anything to write about. It's not at all necessary to look for anything to write about. I live in the world as other people do, you know, fulfill my obligations to the best of my ability at certain times. the imagination becomes engaged with some particular aspect of being alive in the world. And at that time, one writes a poem. It seems quite as natural as doing anything else, getting the urge suddenly to play golf or to go run a mile or whatever other activity appeals to you. I regard poetry mainly as an activity, more nearly than a knowledge. That is to say, the physical, emotional, mental self achieves a kind of coordination at some strong moments in one's life that resembles the shape that an athlete is in, for example. And at that point of maximum coordination, you're able to perform your activity at your maximum ability. You see, at that point, you're ready to write a poem. At that point, the swimmer is ready to swim. The tightrope or tight wire walker is ready to walk the tight wire. The batter in a baseball game finds himself amazingly able to hit the ball, where for some reason yesterday, while he knew everything yesterday that he knows today, he couldn't touch it. He missed it. That particular difficult, fine area when things seem to go by themselves, when you can't miss the ball, it seems, some days, you know? Well, that's, I think, is what the poet waits for and prepares for. He tries to keep himself in shape every day by thinking what his art is and what he can do about it.
Do you ever find yourself longing to give up the energy and go back to being an executive and working in the business world?
Yes, I do. Because there are long periods when the energy doesn't appear. And there's a responsibility for the use of the energy, that you do it well or not. So it's a difficult side.
What keeps you from giving up?
The reappearance of the energy, I guess, overrides your decisions. For example, I would like, I think, in a way, to stop writing now, because it seems to me that I may have done the best I can. How nice then it would be to turn aside to some other new way of life that would be where I could be a beginner and start over. But of course, that decision is overridden by the appearance of another poem. Some of my students, for example, write a good poem today, or have written one in the last week, and then they feel for some time intimidated by that poem, that they already think that they may never rise to that level again. It's a very common feeling. I think that the person very skilled is the one who's going to have the feeling. Because you see, when you understand how subtle and rare the coordinations are that make it possible for you to do something that you never really imagined yourself capable of doing, then you are in danger of the disappearance of that kind of coordination, you see what I mean? And you in particular would be aware that it might be gone forever. Now, I've read that Robert Frost, for example, after each single poem, suffered rather terribly, thinking that was his last. This worry is not something that comes after 30 years of writing, but is something that poets live with, I think, more or less constantly.
The anguish of the poet, the fear of falling from a state of creative grace, as expressed by Bollingen Prize winner A.R. Ammons at Wake Forest University in North Carolina, courtesy of reporter Steve Marlowe.
Supposing you did have a high wire set up And you had a man there who was a specialist in high wire. He knew exactly the material that was used in the high wire in the 18th century. He knew how much pressure was put on the wire in the 17th century. He knew the classic figures that were performed on the high wire in the 16th century, but he cannot walk the high wire. Now, supposing a man who has none of that knowledge comes out of the woods, but he's been walking logs for a long time, crossing swamps and so on, and he comes out and this man says, "Why don't you walk this high wire?" And he merely climbs up and begins to walk it with his own style, rude in some ways, perhaps uninformed in others, but he's able to do it. That is the poet. You see, the poet may or may not be a person who is in charge of all, who has a mastery of the knowledge of the tradition. He's simply a person who knows how to perform the activity. Do you realize that we've been worrying now for 2,500 years about what the nature of a poem, what it is, and nobody knows yet?
If after 2,500 years the real nature of a poem cannot be defined, then maybe it doesn't really matter. At any rate, when you read the poetry of this man, Mr. A.R. Ammons, abstract theories and definitions of poetic construction are replaced by a clear, natural flow of human experience. Mr. Ammons is a poet of major stature, just recently joining the ranks of Wallace Stevens, Archibald MacLeish, E.E. Cummings, Robert Frost, and Robert Penn Warren as a recipient of the prestigious Bullington Prize in Poetry of the Yale University Library. A.R. Ammons comes to us after graduating from Wake Forest College, after working as a glass manufacturing executive, and now holding full professorship at Cornell University. He is now on leave for 1 year to teach at his alma mater, Wake Forest University, and I talked with him recently about himself and his poetry. I asked him first about creative experience.
In your poetry, how do you get the inspiration? Poets have talked about the muse, the divine inspiration that comes to a poet. Do you feel during the writing of that poem whether or not it's going to be a good poem or a mediocre poem?
No, I don't think so. You write the poem because of a willingness to accept whatever is there and to move with it. You don't want to know where the poem is going, necessarily. You want to be willing to move with it to see what can be discovered or found out. Consequently, as the poem realizes itself, you, the writer, can be as surprised by the way it turns out as the reader may be in reading it. Now, as for inspiration, that is not a spooky thing, you know, inspiration. I think it's merely a matter of the attention. Suddenly your attention is seized by something, either that you've seen outside or some idea or image that occurs in the mind. And it's interesting for whatever reason you may not be able to tell at that moment. But your attention is seized and concentrated by that, and you simply, through your interest in it, begin to work with it, and it quite often shows you something new. Each of us has his own, well, what Emerson calls genius, meaning his own nature, his own being, and each of us consequently has different needs. That genius has different needs, so we take day to day the things that interest us most from life.
You've been everything from a graduate of Wake Forest to an executive with a New Jersey glass manufacturer and other various and sundry things, a teacher. Now, how do these experiences affect what you write?
Well, totally, probably.
How do these various experiences work their way into your poetry? Do you ever find yourself writing about things that you've done?
Not as self-consciously. Some reviewers have created for themselves the image of me as a person out walking along the shore or in paths in the woods looking for things in nature to write about. I never look for anything to write about. It's not at all necessary to write for to look for anything to write about. I live in the world, as other people do, you know, fulfill my obligations to the best of my ability at certain times. The imagination becomes engaged with some particular aspect of being alive in the world. And at that time, one writes a poem. It seems quite as natural as doing anything else, getting the urge suddenly to play golf or to go run a mile or whatever other activity appeals to you. I regard poetry mainly as an activity, more nearly than a knowledge. That is to say, the physical, emotional, mental self achieves a kind of coordination at some strong moments in one's life that resembles the shape that an athlete is in, for example. And at that point of maximum coordination, you're able to perform your activity at your maximum ability. You see, at that point you're ready to write a poem. At that point, the swimmer is ready to swim. The tightrope, tight wire walker is ready to walk the tight wire. The batter in a baseball game finds himself amazingly able to hit the ball. Where for some reason yesterday, while he knew everything yesterday that he knows today, he couldn't touch it. He missed it. That particular difficult, fine area when things seem to go by themselves, when you can't miss the ball, it seems, some days, you know? Well, that, I think, is what the poet waits for and prepares for. He tries to keep himself in shape every day by thinking what his art is and what he can do about it.
Who influenced you most as far as poets and writers and literary figures have been considered?
Well, if I can believe the reviewers, I've been influenced by everybody. I don't think they've left out a single name. My earliest awakenings to poetry, I would say, would have to say, were governed by Robert Browning, Walt Whitman, Emerson, and Emily Dickinson.
Do you ever find yourself longing to give up the energy and go back to being an executive and working in the business world?
Yes, I do, because there are long periods when the energy doesn't appear, and there's a responsibility for the use of the energy, if you do it well or not. So it's a difficult time.
What keeps you from giving up?
The reappearance of the energy, I guess. Override your decision.
Yeah.
For example, I would like, I think, in a way, to stop writing now, because it seems to me that I may have done the best I can. How nice then it would be to turn aside to some other new way of life that would be where I could be a beginner and start over. But of course, that decision is overridden by the appearance of another poem. Some of my students, for example, write a good poem today or have written one in the last week, and then they feel for some time intimidated by that poem, that they already think that they may never rise to that level again. It's a very common feeling. I think that the person very skilled is the one who's going to have the feeling, because you see, when you understand how subtle and rare the coordinations are that make it possible for you to do something that you never really imagined yourself capable of doing, then you are in danger of the disappearance of that kind of coordination, you see what I mean? And you in particular would be aware that it might be gone forever. Now, I've read that Robert Frost, for example, after each single poem, suffered rather terribly, thinking that was his last. This worry is not something that comes after 30 years of writing, but it's something that poets live with, I think, more or less constantly.
Do you have a particular message in mind for
No.
people to read?
No, certainly not. I normally have, I think of the poem as a sort of daydream that the mind has already dreamed, but it's below the level of the conscious mind. The poem sort of sticks up a tiny bit of itself into your attention. Then you begin with that and dream the poem out. You know? So it's an activity. It's a narration. It's a telling of events, and then what that event stands for or means is likely to be largely the same for all people, but certainly open to individual interpretation. I would never want to give formulations in the sense of statement or logical discourse about what's good, bad, right, wrong, and so on in the world, because I don't know any better than anyone else. I said, Mr. Schaefer, did you get up to see the comet? And he said, oh no, let it go by, I don't care. He has leaves to rake and the plunger on his washing machine isn't working right. He's not amused by 10 million mile tails or any million mile an hour universal swoosh or frozen gases lit by disturbances across our solar arc.
I have the greatest admiration, for example, for a sort of flawless waiter or waitress. You know, whatever they do it well. And if they do it well, you can see everything that you can see in the poem. You can see grace, economy of motion, accuracy of impulse. All these things, you know, that are just done with apparently effortlessly, but obviously after many trials. Poetry is no different as an action from serving a table properly, or knowing how to sweep off doorsteps, or how to hit a ball, or how to run a miler. You see? That's what makes it so wonderful. It's something one does.
Exactly what they were. After Dr. Mackey died, Mrs. Mackey has continued to live in Wake Forest, and she has continued to be a constructively active citizen in the life of the community and of the seminary. She has extended the realm of her usefulness to serve as a member of the Board of Trustees of Wake Forest University. In a world of specialization and in the mad scramble for money, I am one of the many people who thank God for George Mackey and his unselfish service to so many people, and I am happy that his wife continues to be, in her own way, the kind of blessing that would win his complete approval and make him very happy.